the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it is opposed to any delay in the Palestinian parliamentary elections set for next month. The UK watchdog announces a formal probe into how Prime Minister Boris Johnson paid for the lavish renovations of his Downing Street flat. Also in the headlines, Russia expels 7 European diplomats in a tit-for-tat move amid its recent diplomatic tensions with the Czech Republic. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has once again warned against any delay in the Palestinian parliamentary elections set for next month. The Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem said all election-related matters must be subject to national consensus. He also said that any change to the voting schedule would be, quote, unacceptable. The warning comes one day before the Palestinian Authority is set to hold a meeting to adopt a unified stance of the upcoming vote. Palestinians have already urged the international community to press Israel not to block elections in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. This is the first Palestinian legislative elections in 15 years. Officials fear thousands of people in al-Quds may be unable to exercise their franchise as the process would require a green light from Israel. Leading rights group Human Rights Watch has issued a report accusing the Israeli regime of practicing apartheid policies against the Palestinian people. The report highlights inhumane Israeli practices from settlement expansions to the killings of Palestinians.
A prominent international rights group has accused Israel of pursuing policies of apartheid and persecution against the Palestinian people. Human Rights Watch says the policies amount to crimes against humanity. In a 213-page report, the HRW points to Israeli restrictions on Palestinians' movements and land grabs for the construction of settlements in the territories occupied in 1967, calling them examples of policies that are crimes of apartheid. The rights group said Israeli authorities have pursued intent to maintain domination over Palestinians by exercising control over land and demographics for the benefit of Israelis across the occupied territories. HRW called on the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute individuals credibly implicated in the apartheid and persecution. This says just a few weeks back, the court said it would investigate war crimes by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. This brings to the spotlight the fact that the regime has continued with its violation of Palestinians' rights for decades amid silence of the West in dealing with such crimes.
Well, I think it's very welcome. It really doesn't, to those of us who have any familiarity with the reality on the ground there, there are no real revelations, nothing new. And one of the thoughts that comes to mind is what's taken them so long to acknowledge these realities. But nevertheless, it's welcome that they are acknowledging them now, I think. And the report in particular, I haven't had a chance to read every word of it, but I've skimmed through it and read the summary and so on. One of the things it does that I think the previous statements in this area have not done is to do a pretty rigorous analysis of what international law actually says and to make the case that the realities in Palestine actually match the international legal definitions of these crimes against humanity, specifically the crime of apartheid and something that was new to me as a legal concept, the crime of persecution.
The report by Human Rights Watch highlights how Israel is practicing policies common in an apartheid regime. In this case, the persecution of Palestinians, both in Gaza and the occupied territories, is said to amount to crimes against humanity. Yet Israel continues to practice and execute illegal actions in the occupied territories, despite numerous UN resolutions and condemnations. The UK's Electoral Commission has launched a formal probe into the financing of the refurbishment of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Downing Street apartment. The commission, which regulates party and election finances, said that there are reasonable grounds to suspect an offense or offenses may have been committed. Nonetheless, the premier denied breaking the rules, saying that he had covered the cost personally. He made the denial during the fiery exchange with the opposition leader in the House of Commons, Keir Starmer, however, came down hard on Johnson over the issue.
Mr. Speaker, meanwhile, he talks about priorities. Crime is going up. NHS waiting lists are at record levels, and millions of people are worried about their jobs, including Liberty Steel. Mr. Speaker, don't the British people deserve a Prime Minister they can trust and a government that isn't mired in sleaze, cronyism and scandal?
The controversy about the renovation of Johnson's apartment came after revelations by his former aide, Dominic Cummings. He accused the Premier of seeking to use potentially illegal donations to renovate his residence. Johnson has been under pressure to explain how he paid for the refurbishment that reported to have cost around $280,000. Prime Ministers are given $41,000 of public money a year to renovate the property during their term. The senior British professor has acknowledged institutional racism in UK's universities, saying more needs to be done to support black and ethnic minority students. David Richardson, currently Vice Chancellor of the University of East Anglia, said that there's a lot of evidence that points toward universities perpetuating systemic racism. He noted that students experiencing racial harassment put off reporting because of fears over their grades and career. Richardson made the comments while speaking to the BBC as part of a documentary entitled, "Is University Racist?" He also admitted that many students are not being told about the outcome of racism complaints because of universities' fears over data protection. The documentary showed some of the victims as saying that they were left dissatisfied and that the universities had failed them. Russia has expelled 7 European diplomats for what it called false solidarity with the Czech Republic. Russia's foreign ministry ordered the expulsion of 4 diplomats from Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and 3 others from Slovakia. The move came after these Baltic states expelled Russian diplomats following Prague's allegations over Moscow's potential role in a deadly warehouse blast in 2014 in the Czech Republic. However, Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš has expressed doubt about the alleged Russian involvement in the explosion. Moscow also strongly denies the claims. In a series of tit-for-tat measures, the two countries have expelled a series of each other's diplomats and embassy staff. The European Commission has begun legal proceedings against Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca over its vaccine supplies. The Commission said the proceedings have begun at Brussels Court of First Instance. The Commission accuses AstraZeneca of failing to fulfill its contract for the supply of COVID-19 vaccines. The company is also accused of not having a reliable plan to ensure timely deliveries. The Commission says the proceedings could be concluded in a matter of weeks. AstraZeneca says any litigation is without merit. Under an advanced purchase deal, AstraZeneca had agreed to deliver 180 million doses of vaccines to the EU in the second quarter of 2021. However, the company said last month it would deliver only a third of the agreed jabs. The coronavirus pandemic has caused a crisis in India and Pakistan, as both nations are experiencing a record surge in infection and fatality numbers. We talked to our correspondents in New Delhi and Islamabad for better insight on what's happening in the two countries.
On this program, India posts yet another double record of coronavirus infections and deaths amid severe shortages of oxygen, medical supplies, and hospital staff. The health ministry has registered nearly 361,000 new cases. That's the largest single-day total in the world. Some 3,300 people also died of the virus in the past 24 hours as India's total fatalities surpassed the 200,000 mark. This is while experts believe the official tally vastly underestimates the actual toll in the world's second most populous country. Neighboring Pakistan has also registered a new record of fatalities with over 200 additional deaths. The country's death toll has now passed 17,500. The government is planning to impose stricter lockdowns to fight the surge. Joining us on this segment of the news review, we have our correspondent Munawwar Zaman, who's joining us from New Delhi. Also, we have Kamran Yusuf, who's joining us from the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Munawwar in New Delhi. Munawwar, talk to us about the alarming situation right now in India.
The situation continues to be as it is, and with the every passing day, we are registering more deaths, and we are registering more increase in the number of cases. If we look at the graph, it started with 200,000 cases every day, but today we stopped at more than 354,000 cases and, of course, more than 3,000 deaths. So the death toll and the number of infected people is increasing by the day. And as you said correctly, there's a lack of oxygen supplies in the hospital, lack of space for people to get admitted. Well, that was a different scenario altogether till yesterday. But now what the biggest problem and what the biggest challenge the country right now is facing is the shortage of food. People are not getting food available to cremate their loved ones. There is a high demand for wood. And at the same time, there's a high demand for burial spaces. There is a high demand for crematoriums. Because what the government numbers suggest, I've spoken with many experts as well, and many are of the opinion that the numbers or the government figures that we see on the TV and the newspapers, it's just the tip of the iceberg. And we are talking about a country where 1.3 billion and more people are living. And it's just the state of Maharashtra, New Delhi, and Pune, and Bangalore, and Karnataka, and Uttar Pradesh that are in the limelight. It's just because of the fact, because you have all the national and international media on focus there. But if we talk about rural parts of the country, we don't even have the calculations how many people are dying every day. We're talking about adjoining areas. Let's talk about adjoining areas in New Delhi, which is Ghaziabad, Noida, and Faridabad. These are just adjoining areas, and we are seeing people flocking from there in huge numbers to get admitted in hospitals. Such is the situation, such is the critical situation. And today and yesterday, we saw incidences of doctors and hospital staff being attacked by the public.
All right, thank you, Mahara. Let's cross over to Kamran in Islamabad. Kamran, 200 additional deaths, which is a new record for Pakistan. Bring us up to speed on the situation over there, and also about some of the measures that the government will be implementing. We are hearing of plans to impose stricter lockdowns to fight the surge there.
Yes, first of all, I think during the last 24 hours, Pakistan reported 201 deaths due to COVID-19. And this is, as you pointed out, the highest number since the first case of COVID-19 reported February last year. And also the number of infections is also increasing in Pakistan. The active cases are now more than 80,000. And because of the surge of the COVID-19 cases and the number of deaths, the government has taken certain measures recently. For example, the government has deployed military troops at least in 16 districts to implement the SOPs to ensure that people implement all the protocols. Similarly, now after the surge in these cases, the government is indicating that they may resort to some tough measures, for example, imposing complete lockdowns in some of the cities where the cases are increasing. As you know, that this is the holy month of Ramadan, and during the holy month of Ramadan, usually the markets are full of people. So the government is trying to, prevent that kind of a situation. And there are indications that the government may impose strict lockdowns before the Eid festivities. The situation is at the moment is very critical here, and even the country's Prime Minister Imran Khan a few days back clearly stated that if the government and the people of Pakistan do not follow the SOPs, we may be becoming another India.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. We're going to leave it there. Our correspondent Munawar Zaman joining us from New Delhi. Also thanks to Kamran Yusuf speaking to us from the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. With that, brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come.
Welcome back. American aircraft manufacturing giant Boeing has reported another quarterly loss, sixth in a row, as the coronavirus pandemic continues to take its heavy toll on the aviation industry. The company reported a loss of around $540 million between January and March of this year. However, Boeing said that a rebound was within sight with the return of the 737 MAX to service and the availability of coronavirus vaccines. The company has been in a crisis since March 2019 when U.S. regulators grounded its 737 MAX planes following two fatal crashes. The regulators approved the jet to resume its service in November, but a new electrical problem found in MAX earlier this month has cast a shadow on Boeing's sales plans. Also, growing concerns over COVID variants in India and elsewhere have clouded the aviation industry's recovery. Iran says there are still major differences with the U.S. on who should come back to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal first. After meeting with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal in Vienna, Iran's lead delegate says that there are still big challenges ahead. Tomaleski reports from the Austrian capital.
Following another meeting with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal in Vienna, Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says there are still big challenges ahead. As diplomatic attempts continue to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, the main problem is still who should come back first, Iran or the U.S.
The problem or the challenge is about the sequence of who should come first, who should come first to full compliance and full implementation of its commitments. On that, obviously, there are still differences. Our position is quite clear, and we are not going to change that.
Russia and China support Iran's demand that the U.S. remove sanctions in a verifiable manner first.
We believe it is the U.S. previous administration who first pulled out from the JCPOA. So it's just axiomatic that U.S. should abolish all its unilateral sanctions against Iran as well as any third party in the first place. Before Iran moved to implement the provisions on the JCPOA accordingly. So this is a fundamental issue involving rights versus wrong.
There are also serious differences on which sanctions the U.S. should remove.
Our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration.
Up until now, two working groups have been trying to come up with a final list of U.S. sanctions that need removing and nuclear measures that need to be taken by Iran. From Wednesday, a third working group will begin discussions on timetables and sequence, as well as ways to verify sanctions lifting. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
A recent United Nations report said 2020 was one of three hottest years on record, marked by wildfires, droughts, floods, and melting glaciers, prompting the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres to say the world stands on the verge of the abyss. We now present you an article written by staff writers of Agence France-Presse news agency. The piece is titled "New Study Shows Doomsday Climate Tipping Points Have Wiggle Room." Please stay with us for more of the Agence France-Presse article. Researchers have calculated global warming thresholds that could tip massive ice sheets into irreversible melting, or see the Amazon rainforest shrivel into savanna. But they're saying they're grace periods, giving humanity more time to draw down planet-warming carbon dioxide emissions. More than a dozen tipping points triggered mainly by rising temperatures could unleash catastrophic changes in the Earth's climate system. Scientists said, as the Paris Climate Accord goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius cap above pre-industrial levels slips out of reach, this is potentially very good news, although no reason to relax. Ice sheets atop Greenland and West Antarctic hold enough frozen water to lift oceans a dozen meters, or 40 feet, drowning cities and redrawing the planet's coastlines. Greenhouse gases escaping from Siberian permafrost could overwhelm already belabored efforts to curb man-made carbon pollution. Monsoon rains in South Asia, the polar ice cap, coral reef ecosystems, the jet stream, the Amazon basin, all are vulnerable to point-of-no-return transitions that would radically alter the world as we know it today. Up to now, scientists have focused mostly on temperature thresholds and timing. How much warming will it take to trigger each tipping point? Experts are saying the threshold for the two ice sheets to melt is probably below 2 degrees Celsius and may have already been passed. However, to melt the permafrost in Siberia, it will likely take at least another degree or two of global warming. But new research led by Paul Ritchie and Peter Cox from the School of Engineering, Mathematics and Physical Sciences at Exeter University in England asks a different question. Once a tipping point tripwire has been triggered, can we row back by lowering temperatures, whether by sucking carbon dioxide out of our air or injecting a sunscreen into the stratosphere? Peter Cox, senior author of a study published recently in Nature, told Agence France-Presse, "Our analysis shows that it is possible to overshoot tipping point thresholds without leading to an abrupt and permanent climate change, as long as the overshoot is for a short period of time." He added, "There is a period of grace once the threshold is crossed when it is still possible to avoid tipping." In the study, Peter Cox and colleagues looked at four parts of the climate system: the ice sheets, monsoon rains, the Amazon basin, and the ocean conveyor belt of currents that drives cold and warm water across the globe, known as the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC. Ice sheets and ocean currents, they found through modeling, have slow onset tipping points which unfold on a timescale of centuries. This suggests that even if temperatures rise above the tipping point threshold and set in motion a profound change, there is still time to pull back from the cliff's edge by lowering the global thermometer. Peter Cox said, "The slow time scale of some of the most worrying tipping points gives us a better chance of reversing global warming before we tip into a less favorable world." But the researchers found the same timing does not apply to the Amazon rainforest dieback and disruption of the monsoon rains in Asia, which could flip into a new state within decades. For the Amazon, that shift is also hastened by massive deforestation. William Collins, a professor of meteorology at the University of Reading in England, commented, "The study shows that if temperatures overshoot the tipping point for too long, we may set in place irreversible changes in the climate system, such as dying of the Amazon rainforest." Other scientists not involved in the research agreed with the findings, but cautioned against complacency. Grant Allen, a professor of atmospheric physics at the University of Manchester, told the London-based Science Media Centre, "This may offer a very tiny bit of wiggle room in our expectations of when such dire climate shifts might become permanent and extremely damaging as Earth continues to warm." He added, "But a brief delay to some of global warming's more catastrophic consequences does not mean that it is any less dangerous now." A recent United Nations report says 2020 was one of the three hottest years on record, marked by wildfires, droughts, floods, melting glaciers, prompting the United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, to say the world stands on the verge of the abyss. The report by the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, said in a double blow to millions hit by the extreme climate events, lockdown restrictions linked to the global coronavirus pandemic also delayed crucial assistance in some regions. The State of the Global Climate Report confirms its preliminary findings, including on land and ocean temperatures, and comes ahead of a US-led summit where Washington will seek to restore its credibility on climate change through fresh pledges. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres told the Reuters news agency, "We are on the verge of the abyss. We're seeing record levels in tropical storms, in the melting of ice sheets or glaciers, in relation to drought and heat waves and wildfires." The report showed the global average temperature in 2020 was about 1.2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial period, ranking it somewhere in the top three hottest years on record, alongside 2016 and 2019, despite cooling La Niña conditions. A World Meteorological Organization spokeswoman said it was too close to make a call between them because of the margin of statistical error. Among the indicators heightened were record low Arctic sea ice extents in 2 months of 2020. Around 80% of the ocean experienced at least one marine heat wave last year. The United States saw both the largest wildfires ever and the most hurricanes making landfall. Hurricane Laura alone, which hit Louisiana on 27th of August last year, caused $19 billion worth of damage and economic losses. The report said Death Valley in California also recorded the world's highest known temperature for at least 80 years of 54.4 degrees Celsius, that is 129.9 degrees Fahrenheit, in August of last year. Measures designed to curb the spread of COVID-19 delayed assistance after Cyclone Harold, one of the strongest storms ever seen in the South Pacific Ocean, and after Cyclone Wongfong in the Philippines, where social distancing rules meant residents could not be evacuated in large numbers.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Inside Israel.
Subhuman conditions in Israel for foreign workers and migrants. That's according to a report by Israel's Hotline for Refugees and Migrants NGO. It describes treatment by Israeli authorities of detained migrants akin to torture. Migrants, according to the NGO, are being hit with belts, have lack of contact with the outside world, and receive just moments of free time in the open air in Israel.
14 months you've been in the detention facility in the south of Israel. And 14 months, you make connections, like you said. You are living all day for 14 months with people. And one day, they are seeing you getting out of there. How do they feel about this?
I mean, it is really very sad that being incarcerated there for 14 months. There are a lot of people also for more than that. And there is no any justification at all. They release me without... telling me why, and I'm sure that they gain nothing of incarcerating somebody like me or others who are in Holot right now. There is no gain out of it at all, other than torturing some other human beings.
In one location alone, there are 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women. They are living in subhuman conditions that fail to meet legal standards. A new report by an Israeli human rights group paints a picture of humiliating treatment towards foreign workers and migrants. It shows the extent of unlawful arrest and actual physical violence that they face. The report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants for 2019 gathered dozens of testimonies. It revealed shocking incidents at several migrant detention facilities where migrants are detained. The report states that dozens of detainees were imprisoned for months in several detention facilities all across Israel. In fact, according to the report, authorities in these facilities used extreme methods to control the detainees. These methods include beatings with a belt and the forced use of sleeping pills. One such facility is the Yahalom Detention Center. It is located at Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, the capital. In 2019, it held approximately 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women in subhuman conditions that failed to meet legal standards. Many of the tortured migrants come from Africa and Southeast Asia. Israel's Ynet News cites care worker from the Philippines who worked in Israel for 15 years as saying, "The three of us were locked in a small room, without a TV and without our phones that were confiscated." The report also found that immigration inspectors are now breaking into places of residence by force. Additionally, the report claims that in 2019, there was a sharp increase in the number of deported families. It claims that the actual total number of deportees amounted to 6,694. The data and evidence reveal conduct that violates the High Court's directive and even the immigration authorities' own procedures, according to Sigal Rosen from the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants.
Main trends we identified were detention of those who denied entry to Israel, preventing those who have been denied entry from applying for asylum when they wanted to. There was, again, cases of violence by immigration authority inspectors towards detainees. In the last year, there was a special problem of detention of families with children, school children, ahead of their deportation from Israel. During the last year, the immigration authority started focusing on efforts to detain school-aged children. This population was previously spared from detention and deportation, but in the last year, the immigration started arresting these children, especially in order to deport them. Unfortunately, the Israeli immigration policy is to allow the immigration of Jews only, and whoever is not Jewish and is not entering to Israel under the law of return, but under the entry to Israel law, the Israeli government is doing whatever in its power to arrest and deport him. Well, if Israel doesn't want non-Jews to live in this country, then they just don't need to bring these people. Right now, and actually anytime, there is more than 100,000 legal migrant workers that the government is initiating their entry into the country. It is not reasonable to invite all these people and then to deport them. And this is already amount to torture. Detaining a migrant who committed no crime just because Israel failed to deport him for such long years without any prospect for release is definitely a torture.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Traf Lab says COVID-19 made the situation of some of the most vulnerable workers worse and introduced some highly restrictive targeted policies that had grave impact on their lives. Hopefully, it also created an opportunity to rethink policies and reassess how to address vulnerabilities. Brin says Israel's crimes include ethnic cleansing, bouts of genocide in Gaza, torture of children, theft of land, targeted killings and murder, house demolitions, and myriads more since the squatter entity was unilaterally declared in Palestine by a Polish immigrant in May 1948.
The facts are that Israel signed the UN Convention on Refugees, which means that they're supposed to give refugees and according to international law, regardless of the convention, but they're supposed to give refugees safe haven if they're leaving from a country where they're in trouble, where they're in danger. And obviously that's not what's really happening on the ground. They face a lot of racism, they face a lot of legal and bureaucratic issues. So on the one hand, on paper, Israel is supposed to be treating them in a different way than what's happening on the ground. Of course, I mean, in any country, when an immigrant or an asylum seeker comes for work or to flee danger, they're obviously at a disadvantage, right? Because of language, because of legal issues, because of all kinds of things, and so it's easy to exploit them. Here, we have a particularly difficult situation because, as I explained, most of the asylum seekers are not getting legal and social help from the government. And so, you know, they need to somehow be able to raise their families, to feed their kids. So if they're, you know, working under the table or working at restaurants and being taken advantage of, the system is sort of set up to do that rather than to help. Them.
Okay. So, yes, in general, I think there's a fundamental racist problem in Israel. It has always been an issue in Israel. The targets of the racism have changed. It was either, at the beginning, I would say, the Arab population or the Sephardic population, what we call the people that came from north of Africa and Yemen. They suffer from systematic racism towards even from the beginning. And of course, now that we have the Ethiopian Jews that came to Israel 20, 30, 40 years ago, and of course the asylum seekers coming from Africa, they all suffer from a systematic racist problem in Israel. It's quite unbelievable even. It's heartbreaking. And you can see the results. Actually, the Ethiopian Jews, I was in the trial yesterday of Salomon Tukak, a young Jewish Ethiopian boy that was murdered by the police. Then he was shot by a police officer. We have succeeded to raise awareness, and there's a trial going on, which is quite exceptional. But we know that the trial will not bring anything, and the policeman is not he's not blamed of murdering the boy. He's blamed of, I don't know, some sort of something else. But in general, we have a long list of young Ethiopian boys that are being imprisoned, criminalized, killed. So of course, when it comes to even the Jewish black community, the asylum seekers suffer from it much more. I think basically it stems from the fact that the Jewish community that established the Zionists, that has established Israel, came from Western Europe countries, East European countries. I think they all suffer from racism until today. So basically, I think we brought the racism from Europe to Israel, when you think about the people that established Israel, including my great-grandparents and my family from both sides. So I think they came with the notion that anything that is not European is not equal to them. And of course, I think it had to do with the fact that we had to basically, we're committing ethnic cleansing towards the Arab population in that was here in Palestine. So in order to do that, you have to make them subhuman. And I think that, you know, echoes the way we treated the community, the Jewish community that came, as I said, from the northern part of Africa or from Yemen. They received the same treatment. They have been their culture, their language, everything that they brought with them was valued as not as good as the coming things that came from east of Europe. So basically, I think it's something that's rooted in the Zionists and the Jewish society here in Israel.
The daunting report reveals a sharp increase in the number of immigrant families imprisoned for the purpose of deportation from Israel. And for the first time, it also aimed to detain students. Such torture of migrants is not new. In 2018, the United Nations said that migrants in Israel suffered from abuse and torture before they were ultimately deported. The UN refugee conducted research into the subject and highlighted 80 individual cases of people who risked their lives after they were relocated by Israel and then had to make hazardous journeys to Europe through Libya. The UN said that migrants suffered abuse, torture, and extortion before risking their lives once again by crossing the Mediterranean to Italy after Israel had sent them away. In April 2018, Israel reached an agreement with the United Nations to expel around 16,000 African migrants to Western countries in exchange for granting temporary residency in Israel to the same number. Shortly after, however, the deal was cancelled by the Israeli regime.
All these years, actually, since 2013, when Israel started sending asylum seekers to Rwanda and Uganda, only asylum seekers who decided to move to these countries left. No one was taken there by force. It is correct that many of them felt coerced to go there because of the heavy decrees and laws that locked them down in prison, in Cholot, all the economic decrees that took away such a large amount of their salaries and left them with no means to live. The international law brutally when it deals with both asylum seekers and migrant workers. We see in the case of migrant workers that people are detained in illegal condition, not just according to international law, but also according to the Israeli law. And regarding asylum seekers, we see that Israel do not bother to check the asylum claims. Detain them, coerce them to move to other country, and limit their freedom of movement in a way that violates the Refugee Convention.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Suburb says that an Israeli court rules the city to be a white city and that schools for blacks or funding transport for black school children to attend school elsewhere are liable to alter the city's demographic balance. This could incentivize blacks to move into the city, damaging its white character. Fatima says that the crimes that are happening all over the world against the oppressed Yemenis, Palestinians, Afghans, Indians, Chinese, blacks, etc. are being planned by the United States and Israel. The international community must protest against these atrocities. Ali says the extinction of insects and reptiles is important to the United Nations.
And there are different types of immigrants in Israel. There are migrant workers and there are asylum seekers, as I said. But it's very, very difficult to naturalize in Israel if you're not coming and making aliyah, if you're not coming as a Jew from a different country and trying to live here permanently. It's nearly impossible to naturalize here, including if you're an immigrant, a non-Jewish immigrant that wants to marry or marries outside of the country a citizen. So there's a lot of bureaucracy, and the legal system is not set up to help migrant workers and refugees, and this is why they're a vulnerable community in Israel. And so, you know, even things like getting social services during a global pandemic, as I said, the deposit law was canceled, but there are lots of other issues and social benefits that other people living here, citizens mainly, are receiving that these people are not receiving because they're not really recognized.
And I'm here in order to make a change. We have a prime minister who's divisive, who is splitting the country, who is ruining our economy, and who is undermining the structure of democracy.
I'm coming here to protest for 6 months because our Prime Minister has he's criminal, and he's kind of dictator, and we want him out.
Basically, Israel does not respect any international law. It doesn't respect the international law, the refugee convention. The Geneva Convention, sorry. It has never been committed to anything in the Geneva Convention regarding asylum seekers, regarding refugees. But it also does the same thing towards the Palestinians. There are no international laws, none whatsoever, that Israel respects. Even the deportation, they found a system with these third countries. I call them the revolving door. Rwanda and Uganda, which they did not even allow to say their name in courts. By the way, I went to Uganda, and we also had connections with parliament members of Uganda. That's one of the reasons that his program has failed. We collected testimonies, and we know that Israel has done everything it's in its power to either walk around these international laws or disregard them in general. I would even say that the Supreme Court of Israel itself does not respect the international law. It doesn't say so out front, but it definitely does everything in its power to override these international laws. Public pressure create a change? No. Public pressure, if it's not, governments cannot create a change, okay? The whole BDS movement, which basically Israel is very worried by it, cannot really create change because we're not talking about governments. We're talking about private people, NGOs, or whatever. If the only way, I think, basically, if you ask me, and this is what we have worked towards with 2018, when we were hoping that the deal with the UN would go through. Israel will never accept its small amount of asylum seekers. We're talking about a very small, we're talking about less than 30,000 asylum seekers that are even not called asylum seekers. They're called infiltrators. They're called infiltrators by the court, by the Supreme Court. No, these people will never receive fair treatment. They will never be considered human beings, basically.
The migrants that have been tortured include workers that have been working in Israel for decades. They are cheap labor and working conditions that Israeli employees do not. They do not receive any incentives or benefits. In fact, many of them do not see their paychecks in years. Israel has been allowing this to go on for decades. To many of these migrants and laborers, they are being treated as modern-day slaves. Israel has promised them savings forcefully cut from their paychecks if they leave. Israel has been wanting them to leave for years. Now it is executing mass imprisonment of this minority group of people. It remains to be seen what actions the UN will take after the latest torture report in Israel.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.